Let's get started again. We've had a series of talks by former legislators giving us some institutional background as to what's going on. We're going to move on now. I just want to talk about methods that might be used to meet the charge that we have, which is to come up with an actual number for the salary for legislators. We have Jim Lee, who's a long time, well, now retired, but he's a long time to get a little more official in the Department of Employee Relations and later in
Thank you. Just a minor clarification on the agenda. When I saw it online, I flinched a little bit. I don't want to mislead anybody. I don't represent the municipal management budget. I am a former state employee. State compensation manager for 27 years before we have been budgeting for existence. And I spent 10 years with the state college exclusion system while I took budgets in its infancy. I'm going to talk about a lot of things that you may at first glance think don't have a lot of application for your task. And I know that coming in. We do have a somewhat unusual situation. As the state's compensation manager, I remember had two set salaries for state employees who were known to also rely on other income, whether from the state or from outside employment. We always basically use full-time employment as our basis of analysis and make when a state agency wanted to create a new body of work, if you will, whether it was a single position or a classification of multiple incumbents, they would start by writing a job description. What is the person expected to do? What limits do they have on their authority to act? Who do they report to? What kind of a budget might they be responsible for if they do have budget responsibilities? What legal parameters they work with them, that kind of thing. Reporting relationships include also who they use supervisor in their description or in the job. And the description also contains some information about minimum qualifications. And if you're looking for a research analyst or an auditor, it's relatively easy to come up with a set of qualifications. So if you're looking for this kind of experience and this amount of experience and this educational background. Dealing with legislators, of course, you're people who have 201 different resumes. And they're all considered qualified for the position because they were elected. So it's a bit different. And it does provide an additional challenge. The next step in the process would be in order to assign this new job classification or position to a pay range, you would need to do some sort of a job analysis that could be as simple as, well, this job looks a lot like this other existing job classification that we have. It's similar enough in terms of the qualifications and the work. That we can either just use that classification or create one to send the salary. If there's some dispute about making a job match on that basis, employers can use a job evaluation system. The state uses the Hay job profile system. It assigns a numerical score to a position or a classification of jobs. Pay raters have been trained by a pay organization to sit down, and they usually work in committees of this storm. There are probably a number of state employees who can tell you what their case going from and say that most of them don't. Having is sort of like your credit score, the higher is better. State jobs run in the range of about 108 points at the low end to about 3,500 at the top end for agency guys. The usefulness of that numeric score is that you can use it to then make comparisons to jobs that on the surface don't look comparable. If you have an 1,100 point job, you can then look at your existing 1,100 point jobs and use that as a guide to how much they ought to be paid, that the new jobs should be paid. A more statistically rigorous approach is to do a trend line analysis where you plot out pay points on the vertical axis, pay points on the horizontal axis, excuse me, and salaries on the vertical. And it usually generates a scattergram that doesn't look all that great in terms of giving you any assistance, but you can reduce it statistically to a line. That line is converted to a formula. So you can take any given pay rating, put it in the formula, and we'll tell you what the perfect pay rate would be for the job, in an ideal world. But because this line isn't always straight, it's usually curved, sometimes the statistically perfect range doesn't really match up with the rest of the reality. So on the 1,100 point job, for instance, the formula might say one thing, but when you look at the 1,100 point jobs you've already got, they might be paid either above or below this supposedly perfect range. So there is a way of analyzing jobs and assigning them job scores, pay ratings, that allows you to kind of get past the fact that one job is a scientific job, the other one's an auditing position, except for even across occupational lines. After you've done the analysis, if you go as far as the job rating, you look at the other job classifications that you've currently got. And you look at the position that the new position is going to report, the existing position does report, to make sure that you've got a suitable difference in salaries in the reporting relationship. We also look then at positions in the same agency that have similar responsibilities. One example, for instance, would be natural resources. They have a forester class series, a forest class series, one for fish and game, wildlife. And so if you're creating a new position in forestry, for instance, you not only would look within the forestry series, but you would also look to see what comparable rated jobs in parks and recreation and wildlife would be. Now, with state government and local government in Minnesota, there is a heavy emphasis on pay effort that a lot of the private sector employers would not necessarily take into account. So the approach that I've described so far really focuses internally is how are we going to be in this position compared to other positions in our organization? When we look at the external market in the state government, it's really on an exception basis. If the department comes in and says, well, we need to create this this new title, but we know from our research that we're not going to be able to attract people if we simply go through process of doing a pay rating and assigning it to a pay range based on internal comparisons. I can't remember the title, but a number of years ago. One of the departments approached me and said, well, we need to create this class. And we already know there's only 400 people in the country that can do the work. But it puts you in line. You have to set aside whether it's going to allow you to compete for those 400 people. So what we do if they have a documented market problem, either it's an existing class and they're losing people, they're not able to fill vacancies, or it's a new class and you know from salary survey data that you're not going to be able to just pay an intern at the equitable salary and still fill positions. You then have to look at, are you looking at the national, regional, or local recruiting market? And again, here, legislators are different. We don't recruit in California. Legislators, candidates are recruited from outside the state of Minnesota. We had some of the same issues with the compensation council, I think, when it came to constitutional officers. So yeah, it's informative to know what other states pay their governors, but we're not exactly in the business of trying to attract people from other states to be the governor. You also have to look at whether or not you're competing in the public or the private sector or both. Many of the state jobs are, of course, unique in public sector, but there are quite a number of them where we are in direct competition with the private. In looking at salary survey data, you can do job matching, sometimes just using the FICA will be enough. The positions are unique enough that the title is essentially commonly used by all employers. But more frequently, the salary survey matching is done on the basis of a 2 or 3 sentence description of work, and also some indicator. Are we looking at an auditor versus an accountant? And if it's an auditor, are we looking at an entry level auditor, attorney level auditor, or maybe a lead auditor or something? So you get the advantage of having some job matching. Now again, with legislators, you might be able to make the assumption that a legislator is a legislator no matter what state they're working. The duties are going to be relatively the same. The alternative sources of external data. You've already looked at the National Conference of State Legislators data. There's also a Council of State Governments data. The Book of States has data on legislators, constitutional officers, judges, etc. And sometimes if another state has already established some sort of a comparable salary setting process, like Dr. Stinson is talking about the state of Washington as a full-time organization that sets salaries for state officials. So sometimes just getting copies of their work, which is generally public data, will help you out. You can use as a salary survey, if you will. And then for some jobs, commercial salary surveys. You purchase a survey from somebody like Towers Watson and the other big consulting organizations. The other alternative to doing a salary survey or a job matching kind of a thing that legislature, the Compensation Council have done in the past, is to create linkages between positions in state government. Right now, the salaries of the Attorney General, Secretary of State, and Lieutenant Governor are set as a specific percentage of the governor's salary, so whatever the governor gets a pay increase, so do the others. The three previous compensation councils all, one way or another, got to the point of making a recommendation that legislators should make one-third of what the governor makes. Those recommendations weren't adopted by the legislature, but that was where two different compensation councils eventually got there. There were some other linkages for a long time. The governor's salary served, or a percentage of the governor's salary, served as the limit on what the governor can pay state agency has. But in 2013, that was largely done away with a different limit established that is tied to the single pension. Besides making comparisons to other legislators, we're doing a job evaluation rating for our legislators and comparing it to state employees in the executive branch, using the job score. These are some sources of information that I think might be of interest to you. And if I had to do this by myself, I would probably look at least a few of these. Looking at the salaries paid to salary people in the state general, both public and private sector. You can get data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Just saying, if you're a salary employee and you live in the state of Minnesota, your average salary is this, your median salary is that, they might have percentiles available to them. Just as a frame of reference, you can look at exempt employees of the executive branch. It's largely managerial, most of the supervisory employees, and good share of professional employees would be exempt. By example, the example of the overtime law and enforced salary. That would be a frame of reference. The legislature does have oversight over what the executive branch employees make, but they don't set the salaries directly. They act upon contracts negotiated by the committee and compensation plans given by management budget. Approve them, but they don't have the level of control over actual salaries that they decide on each individual makes. You could further refine that and say, well, instead of looking at all exempt employees in the executive branch, let's look at agency heads, managers, and exempt supervisors. Those are people who have got some responsibility for policy making. Some legislators would dispute that anybody in the executive branch makes policy, especially for the managerial supervisory level. But sometimes the legislation that comes out and affects what a department needs to do is fairly broad, and you need to make a number of decisions about implementation that effectively are policy. The PEPRI Act, for instance, in the early 80s, is fairly broadly written, and I was the compensation manager at the time. So when we did implement it, there were a number of decisions we had to make about how we were going to measure comparability between the available people and available jobs, and how we were going to administer certain parts of the Pay Equity Act that were more in the weeds in the legislature, community vote. Another comparison, I heard reference to this earlier today, would be to look at what the salaries are for full-time county commissioners and city council members. Representative Holberg was at $73,000. So lucky at Ramsey and Hamilton County and some of the others that have full-time or nearly full-time legislative bodies, if you will, would be interesting, and that data is readily available. It's public information. It's gathered by the Association of Minnesota Counties and the League of Minnesota Cities. And then the last bullet refers to I guess only the data would think about this, but there is the unemployment insurance statute exempts certain kinds of public employees from unemployment insurance benefits. There are people who are holding or are considered major policy making positions. And legislators themselves are included in that category. And so are a number of state employees, mostly managers, agency heads. And it would be relatively easy to pull out data on them, because in the payroll system, there is a code to differentiate these people from other people who are eligible for unemployment insurance. So that when the wages are reported to D, the unemployment folks, they can put them in one bucket and they can put the people who are eligible for unemployment benefits in a different bucket. And that comes into play then when these people leave their jobs, and many of them go down to collect unemployment insurance, and they find out that they were in a position that was exempt because they were a major policy position. So it's a way of focusing on policy making executive branch positions. And if you look at the median or mean salary for those, it might give you sort of a jumping off point, a reference point. And if you're comfortable with it, you can then take whatever percentage of that you feel is appropriate, because that's going to be a full-time employment for a full-time salary number. You can decide what percentage of a legislator's time is actually spent on legislative duties, and take a portion of the executive branch employees in that group. Just a thought. And obviously, if you did all five of these things, you're not going to end up with the same number at the end. You're not going to come out with the same result. But it starts to narrow and fall. It starts to focus your thinking. I mentioned the medians and means earlier. Sometimes it's helpful to look at quartiles. If you're setting up a range for the minimum and maximum, I would typically look at the 25th and 75th percentile. In other words, you want to pay state employees somewhere in the middle of the range of salaries beyond the also. Throw out the lowest 25%, throw out the highest 25%, and focus on the middle. Since you're setting a single salary rate, you might want to look at either the mean or the median. As I said, for a trend in the pattern, you're not going to look apply five different sources of data and come up with, they all say the same thing. So look for a trend or a pattern. Not a precise mathematical result. The current salary is $31,141 or something like that. Most people will look at that number and say, well, somebody really crunched some numbers and came up with the right salary. Well, it's just the result of applying percentage increases to some salary rather than a salary 20 years ago. One of the things that you should consider is aging data forward. Sometimes we collect external data, actually all the time we collect external data. It is somewhat old. It might be a few months old. It might be a year old. It might be 18 months old since the data was collected. So one of the things that we would do is age the data. We would figure out some factor using the consumer price index and the cost index, which is a measure of how much salaries and benefits have gone up over a period of time. And then some commercial surveys also ask their survey participants to tell the surveyor how much they expect the salaries in their organization to go up in the next year or two. There's a number of ways you can age the data, but it's a matter of factoring it forward. So if you have data that's a year old or 18 months old, your setting salary is going to go into effect on July 1st of this year. You can adjust it upward to adjust your external data upward to July 1st of 2017. And then, you are setting a salary that's going to be in effect for 2 years. Normally, state employee salaries, salary structures are in effect for a year. We set them, management budget negotiates and sets salaries 2 years at a time, but there's usually a first year salary schedule and a second year salary schedule. We're going to be setting a salary that will be in effect for 2 full years. So one of the things that you can consider is whether or not you want to factor in another year or two of external salary growth into your calculation. So rather than saying, well, having aged all of our external data, we think that X is the perfect salary for July 1st of 2017, you might want to think about what that salary would be either in 2019 and set your salary, you know, to try and approximate that, which would be a lead kind of approach to things. So what you're saying is we don't mind, quote, overpaying for a little bit, but we're going to be competitive. It's usually a tactic used where you've got highly skilled, somewhat hard to find kinds of employees in your organization. And as an organization, you are basically saying, we want to overpay for a little while, so we don't need to worry about being competitive for a couple of years. A more common approach is a lead lag. Approach where you say, okay, we're going to go a little bit higher for the current market, but we're not going to adjust salaries for a little bit, so we know we're going to be a little bit lower for the market in a couple of years. And what that allows you to do is to exceed the market by a more reasonable amount, and then you're going to be under the market by a reasonable amount at the end of 2 years. Now, lag theory of compensation is the kinds of employees you've got are somewhat, they're easily replaceable. They have a short training period. You can get people up to speed pretty quickly. So you're not that worried about retention. And there's also a large pool of qualified people in your workforce. So you're just not, and for a bunch of reasons, for, you know, your bottom line, you're going to consciously choose to be less than your competitors for the entire period. You're going to start off, at or near the middle market, but you don't really mind being fairly far behind the market by the end of your period. just another comment. That's the end of my slides, but you know, you are talking about what I would call total cash compensation. Total compensation, in other words, cash would include salaries, the per diem, expense reimbursements, benefits, insurance, etc. But you're really looking at total cash compensation, so the statutory salary plus their per diem income. In my mind, I would disregard anything that's really an expense reimbursement. And then, as I said earlier, you've got a somewhat challenging job in this workforce of 201 people. Can either, as a body, either the House or the Senate, can adjust the per diem rates, or as individuals, they can adjust their income. They can decide not to take all of the per diem that's available to them. So it's a real different situation than I was faced with in setting salaries in the executive branch. It's, but you just have to understand what it is you can control and what you cannot. With that, I'll take your questions.
Thank you. Let me ask the first question. You had a slide earlier on that said that the Compensation Council suggested or recommended the legislative salaries be 30% of the governor's salary. Can you talk a little bit about how they got to that recommendation, or what the basis for that is? I guess it's a third, not 30%, but it turns out that's about where we are.
Okay, what, the governor is what, 126 years old right now?
I think that it came back.
And Mr. Gilbert can probably shed more light on this than I did, because the staff of the Compensation Council, I was extremely interested to observe, especially once they got the agency campaign. But I think it was generally a feeling of maybe most of the people that it was about a one-third time to run on their time. But also, I don't know to what extent they took the review.
Mr. Hughes,
I don't believe it was a scientific analysis. I think there was an eyeballing. The governor was about here, and it seemed like a third of that would be an appropriate salary for legislators. I don't think it was much science about whether it should be 25 or 30 or 40%. Well, there was some discussion about it being 40%, but that was just a number that was arrived at through discussion.
Do they include per diem in their salary?
I think just as per diem is a central topic here, it was a constant variable when they were talking at the Compensation Council. So I think that factored into it, but I don't know I don't remember that it was explicit.
So tell me when they did this, when they...
Bill, you need your microphone.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. When they did this, they recommended a third of the governor's salary in addition to per diem.
The council understood that number is also in C per diem, yes.
And do you know how much per diem on average is?
So I think at the first meeting we had a handout that showed the maximum per diem in the Senate and the House. It varies whether it's a long session or a short session. Ballparks, it's about $10,000 for a senator and was it $8,000 for a House member?
It was $7,826 for the House member in 2015 versus $5,096 in 2016. And the Senate's was $12,095 in 2015 versus $76,79 in 2016. So representing the shorter legislative sessions, I would assume.
So if we take that to the compensation salary, then they were really recommending a salary of about $50,000, or slightly above.
The other question I had was, how do you think about taking into account health insurance, in particular, when you're doing comparable salaries across different organizations?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because I've actually scribbled a note to bring up about insurance. When looking at comparisons to other employers,
yes,
we didn't really factor it in that much. We just didn't have the capacity to do the depth of analysis, the way to go out and calculate the value of somebody else's benefit plan.
So you assume,
we rarely took a close look at differences in benefits. And if your competitors are other states, I think we just made the assumption, maybe for our convenience, that the benefits wouldn't be dramatically different than what Minnesota offers. The point that I had scribbled a note about to bring up was that the value of using some segment of executive branch employees as a comparison is that it is the same health insurance program. The retirement contributions are pretty much the same, except that many of the managers would be in a defined benefit plan, not in a defined contribution retirement plan. But if you start to narrow it to high-level major policy-making positions, you're probably starting to also increase the percentage of people who are in a defined contribution plan like the flood insurance.
So if I understand what you told me, that you don't see any problem with assuming that if you're making cross-state comparisons or something like that,
I think you can be fairly comfortable just disregarding any differences in benefits. Sometimes it's helpful to look at the presence of benefits as opposed to the value. In other words, do legislators from other states get state health insurance? Do they have a retirement? Without trying to get in and see the benefits. The only time that I actually got into the detail of looking at specific benefit packages and actually to the level of looking at the tax rates in different states was by making counteroffers to employees who have been offered jobs elsewhere. And I could do some research and put together a package that says, in this state, with your benefit package and the state's tax load, you're better off staying here for X amount of money than going there for Y amount of money. But that's about, you can't do that for 2,500 different job classifications of 50,000 employees.
One final question. What does it cost to have, if we were trying to do a hate evaluation of legislators or a policy evaluation of legislators, you'd have to contract with an HR firm of some sort. What would the cost be? Do you have any idea?
No, there's two approaches you can take. One would be to contract with the Hay organization itself. And I don't know, Mr. Minister, did they do a rating on legislators back in the early 2000s?
I don't believe so.
So you could contract with them to do it, and I really don't know what the cost would be. A lower cost approach would be to ask the Department of Management budget to assemble a redo. But there are some logistical issues with getting a redo. You have a deadline of March 31st. I don't know that you could get either a contract in place or maybe you could free up the people to talk to legislators and gather the information you need to do a hearing in the time. But maybe that's something that can be done in the interim after this report is issued and before the next science council meetings.
Dr. Manson?
Not that I would put it on the table, but I'd like to kind of have a shy away from that percentage thing, like, or anybody's salary, the governor's. I think we're kicking the can down the road. I think we're taking the chicken way out. I think that we have a real responsibility to base it on some hard facts, research that we've done, and I think the other problem with that, it becomes another political issue down the road again. So again, we can make up our own mind, but where I'm sitting, I just sort of see that as something that was presented to us, but not to pursue that, because I just believe it's not the charge we're given, and it's not the responsible way to go about our decision.
I agree with Dr. Manson. I too am a train, okay? So we used it in my organization 15 years ago, okay? But frankly, most private sector has totally went away from hay because they don't see it as a real good job match, okay? Because frankly, change a few words in the job description and all of a sudden you get added points, and everybody's using market-based studies right now. And if we're gonna look at stuff, I really encourage us to look at market-based studies versus somebody's perception of somebody else's job. Just a comment.
I agree with Dr. Mason's comment. I put the information about what past compensation councils recommended on the slide, but a little bit of reservation. I'm not recommending that approach is going right. I would recommend against it, because the unintended consequence is that whatever you establish a link to, whether it's a formal link or an informal one, the legislature controls the governor's salary. So you start to get into a loop. You know, can they give themselves a pay increase by increasing the governor's salary? And I just don't think it's a good idea.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Reedy?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate your coming. This breadth of knowledge that you brought to this has kind of been a little bit of a sobering conclusion of the day. We need to talk a little bit about the next steps. And up to now, we've had a meeting every 2 weeks. I think that we could probably go until the 28th, if Fridays are still good for people, until the 28th, until we have our next meeting. But given that we have a responsibility to be done at the end of March, I would think that tentatively we should be thinking of having a meeting every Friday after the 24th. Yeah. So the 24th, then the 3rd, and then the 10th, and the 17th. And, at the next meeting, what I think we should be moving toward is a discussion covering some of these issues that we've all been thinking about but haven't really had a chance to talk about. But Mr. Beavers and I will do is produce a list of comparable salaries. I'm not sure how many, but 5 to 10 different comparable salaries, the same way that Mr. Lee talked about it here. And then we'll open it up for discussion, and we'll see if we can begin the process of narrowing down the recommendation we're going to make. The other thing that we're going to have to talk about some, and it's probably not a good idea to start this discussion now, but is what form the recommendations that we produce will be transmitted. One possibility is to just make a recommendation and send it. Another possibility is to have a report that is referenced in the recommendation. But if we have a report, that raises the question as to what the report covers. We have this issue of the per diem in there. Do we want to talk about the per diem separately? How do we deal with this combination of per diem salary with the only control of salary? So those are some of the things that we can talk about at the next meeting. This person.
What type of salaries are you going to be comparing?
Well, I'm not sure, but I thought one solution is to say where we should be. You know, another solution is to say they were right in 1999 as to where it should be, but they should have adjusted for inflation, so we have that. Another would be something to do with the median household income. Another would be some comparable jobs, county commissioner, city council, neighboring states. What if we were comparable to Iowa or to Wisconsin? As Mr. Lee mentioned, the state of Washington has actually council, not too dissimilar from this council, but they, several years ago, went through something like the Hague process, only it's more public sector oriented, called the Willis process, came up with a number, so we should take a look at theirs, and again, take into account both the per diem and the salary in there. So, if you have some suggestions, let me
know. Well, I'm wondering if we're looking at, like, other governmental units, if we shouldn't include population in budget or something like that, so we have some comparison of size.
Sure.
And maybe there's other things we are interested in, too.
So if I understand what you're saying, we could look at the size of the House or Senate district, population of this House or Senate district that's being served, since if you're serving twice as many constituents.
Or county size?
Yeah.
If you're looking at county commissioners?
Mr. Minister.
I could see you, you can't see that you're left there. But anyway, having said that, before we get to the numbers, which we obviously have to get to, we're going to have, as a group, come up with some core beliefs or premises that we believe in, that these are things that I think we're going to start thinking about this, have a draft at the next meeting, or talking about this. These are the principles that we're going to make this recommendation on. There could be 5, there could be 10, but I do believe that eventually, when we're going to be held accountable for our recommendations, we have to come up with something that hopefully most of us agree on as the core principles of how we're going to make this decision.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, have we established, I realize we had a budget that was as of a date from November. As I mentioned to Mr. Hubinger, excuse me, I never pronounced things right. Is there a more recent budget forecast? Because we have to be using that. That's the words in the statute.
The answer is there is not.
And there won't be one before March 31st?
There will be one come out Monday after the 24th.
After the 24th of March, huh?
No, after the 24th of February.
Oh, well then we gotta get a copy of it, or otherwise somebody could get mad at us appropriately. Then the second thing is that you keep talking about recommendation. We established the salary.
That's right.
So there's no recommendation. And I don't mean to be difficult, but it's scary. I mean, it isn't scary because we all signed up for it, but I mean, that is our job, set the salary. And then the last thing is that, you know, all the information that we gave us, it says that we have to file a report besides set the salary. So I would assume that everything that we've used, all these slide presentations, all those other things, even the transcripts, because you do have transcripts, they should be part of our report, just because people should look at what we analyzed, no matter what number we establish. And one of the, and then the last thought I had is that I mentioned Mr. Hubinger that I would like to have like last year's per diem, just because this per diem thing seems to be such a big thing. I was surprised that he says it's basically a difference of $8,000 to $10,000 at the max. And I thought this was going to be some huge. I mean, I'm not saying $8,000 to $10,000 is a huge number, but if it's only $8,000 to $10,000, I do think we have to say we've taken into account, and I think the legislature has to take it into account. But whether or not they listen to us or not isn't our problem. We got to set a fair and reasonable salary in my way. And maybe what Dr. Metzen, I don't know if the words I'm using, fair and reasonable salary, are the right words, but I think we should say what we thought we'd done so people can understand it. If the words are fair and reasonable, that's fine. Well, I'm done.
Along that same line, I am interested in the concept that was proposed by several of the legislators today regarding a conditional increase in salary based on the legislature itself. My question is really from experience from the Attorney General's office, is whether we are able to make a conditional set. So if we were to say, and I'm just going to throw out some random numbers here that mean nothing, that the legislator's salary is $50,000. However, in the event that one or both of the bodies, that, you know, one or both of the chambers elect to eliminate their per diem, that it will go up to Y. Is that within the purview of our authority?
I don't read that to be within the scope of the council's authority, as we discussed at the last meeting. It really is just prescribing a number rather than conditioning it on performance-based goals. However, the report that's required by the statute provides an opportunity to set out the reasoning, so certainly there could be a strong statement as to what might affect the decision for the next prescribed salary in 2 years.
Right, and I heard what you said the last time regarding the performance-based question, and because that proposal by the citizen who came and testified had to do with linking it to performance and voting on certain numbers of bills, things like that. This would simply be if they eliminated the salary or the per diem, then this other form of salary would spring. And so it's not performance based in a sense, in the same way as what was proposed before.
And I understand, I think the analysis at the end of the day ends up being the same as prescribing the salary, which is the fixed compensation for the regular services. So certainly there could be a strong warning as to what might affect the council's next decision in 2 years from now.
Mr. Poole.
I think what the Assistant Attorney General is saying is that in our report, we reflect the per diem, and then we say because this thing meets this, whether or not, like, I'm the even number, so I could be gone next time around. But we write our report in such a way, and other commissions that'll be meeting write it in such a way where they say, you know, what they think about the per diem, and it would, and we would recommend that it be adjusted and taken into account in the next 2 years. You know, I think that would be the only way it would sort of make it. The report should be an ongoing statement based upon all the factors that we weigh, you know, all the benefits, which is a requirement of the legislature, but also all the things we've studied.
And I think that that's correct. I just wanted to get that formal weigh-in on that proposal because it was something that was being encouraged to us today. And to your point, Mr. Boyle, that we are to prescribe the salary, that that's our job, but then also to the discussion of what our recommendations are, it becomes, the report then becomes more than just the salary description.
Oh, I agree.
So I hearing the encouragement that we should go beyond just the prescription and be forward looking to the next councils and what they are, you know, what they're going to consider, I think is part of our, you know, part of our job as well.
So I have a question regarding, can we split this over the 2 years? Or is it just simply setting it for 1 year to be done? 1 year that covers the 2 year period?
It's for the one single 2 year period. So if you wanted to account for a cost of increase, you'd probably have to average that out over the 2 years.
Mr. Crystal, did you have a question? Does anybody else have any other questions or anything you want to bring up?
Is our goal to have this all done, report and all, which I just wanted to state it, by the 17th for sure, because, you know, if our deadline's 31st, at least I grew up once I became a lawyer, and I have a deadline. I want to get way before the deadline if I've got it, if it's something that's important, which about is everything. So, you know, I mean, is our goal to get this done, report and all, draft report, completed by the 17th? I would hope so.
Who will, Mr. Kubinger, are you going to be drafting the report? Who will actually draft the report?
I think the chair and I are talking about that after this meeting adjourns.
I missed the question, I'm sorry.
I just asked who was actually going to draft the report.
You may say, but I really believe that we should be thinking between now and next week some people willing to take the time to work with the two of them. I think it's going to be important that it doesn't look like two people. I think it's got to be a representative of this group, people that volunteer to work on it, not to take decision-making way, but to do a lot of the legwork. So we don't sit around with 16 people trying to put it together in a very short time framework. So my thought process, maybe by the end of the next week, that we have a subcommittee form to start drafting and working on the report for the following Friday.
Mr. McElroy.
Just a question on the schedule. I kind of like the idea of picking up the pace, and I think some people are saying that, so we don't get down to the deadline. Are you saying we were going to meet next week?
No, 2 weeks.
2 weeks from now. Is there any appetite for maybe expanding the day when we do meet and finishing this earlier, this report earlier in March, and bringing it right down to the end?
Yeah, I would personally prefer to have longer meetings versus more meetings. Joe and myself are traveling a long ways. It's just not the meeting, it's the 5 hours each way that adds on to it.
And the risk of missing.
Yeah, and the risk of missing.
So can we make the next meeting an all-day meeting or something like that? Because it seems to me it's hard to draft a report since we haven't ever talked about any of the issues. Some of us take through the questions, you hear what people think about per diem. But it would be good, I think, to have that sort of plenary discussion. Then have a draft report for the meeting after the 24th.
I think that's a good idea, Alan. You know, we have a problem. The problem is we have a short period of time to get something drafted. And like you said, it's hard to draft something if we don't know what we're agreeing to or anything. And so,
yeah, I just don't know what other people think about all these things. Whether people, anybody thinks maybe the salary ought to go down.
That's really what I was suggesting. Work a full day meeting on the 24th, our next meeting, and then pick up the pace of meeting and we're looking at drafts in March.
Yeah, and then it seems to me that one result from that meeting may well be that we can have one or more drafting committees. It may be that we want to have a draft on the per diem issue by itself, and then something on salaries, something more general. So, Mr. Holmes?
No, I didn't have a question.
Tom, do we see ourselves having any more presentation or we start reading pretty much being by ourselves? That's question number one. Another thought process is a group of 16, it's hard. I'd like to see maybe have a general discussion and then break out into kind of subgroups with the same topic, and then come back and see how many things were in agreement. That it's a more efficient way of getting at it, but also involves more people. Some of us talk too much, some of us talk much at all, and everybody has something to offer here. So I think breaking into smaller groups will get everyone personally involved. Plus, it will bring us to a point, I think, let's say we have four groups, that we'll see, all four of these groups agree on these four principles.
How do you do that with an open meeting law that you can break into?
No, we're right here. We're not going anyplace. I see it right here. You know, we're under the building here someplace. Just break into corners.
Okay.
And take an hour and four people in a group of five to come up with your core principles that you think about.
I'm wondering if we could authorize the staff to already start to tab this stuff, like the initial salary plus the rate of inflation puts the number at this, whatever that is. I don't know what it is, but it's something we should be taking into account. We got to make sure we have a tab on the most recent budget because that's the law, and a tab on other legislatures of other counties, or other states. We could develop those tabs now, staff could. So we all have those numbers, because anyone, when we set our number, we'll be basing it on all that stuff. And of course, we have to base it on all the remuneration, the per diem, and whatever those numbers are, and the analysis of those numbers, and the retirement benefit at the present time, and the other benefits, including health insurance. So, and I guess there's probably life insurance too, I guess. So all that stuff should be tabbed, just because we should be taking that into account, gotta be clear. And it's just a matter of putting it all in there. Actually, it might be easier for us to analyze this rather than just keeping our stuff from the meetings together via tabs. Anyway, that's all I have.
Mr. Fox?
Tom, I'm curious to answer David's question. Do we have other people that are coming in to provide us with information? I, for one, am ready to try and get to work.
We have nobody scheduled to come in from this point on. If people think somebody would be useful, we can always adjust the schedule for that. We have nobody scheduled from this point on.
One last thing. I've been here. I think there is a cafeteria in this building, so we just have to just go to the cafeteria for a short lunch period. Or maybe they'd even serve us something. I don't know.
There isn't a cafeteria.
There isn't?
There's a lunch.
Yeah, but isn't there, they serve lunches, don't they?
There's one in the Centennial Building.
No, there's one in this building. I sat there and prepared for court.
There's one in the building. I think it's intermittently open.
Oh, well, maybe we could see if it's open.
If you came over and you argued, you would go have lunch, but you can't do that.
Oh, I thought it was open in the room, but I didn't run.
Tom, I want to be very careful. I suggest or not suggest, ask about who's coming in. If there's somebody really important or somebody should be here, I don't want this to be an absolute. I think we've got to be flexible enough that if there's somebody on this committee or you come up with that you think this would really be useful for us, please don't take that as an ultimatum.
No, I certainly didn't.
Okay.
And we always have an option for public testimony today.
Well, if there are no more questions, we have a motion to adjourn.
Good luck.
Second. I think our phone is on, so I think we can do this.
Yeah.
For us, for all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Motion's carried.